Jesus was sent by God the Father to bring salvation to the world. That's a pretty tall order, isn't it? He had only 3 years to accomplish his public ministry. That's a blink of an eye in comparison with the enormity of what he was to accomplish here on earth. His ministry has just begun in John chapter 2. Jesus has just been baptized by John in the Jordan River, as we commemorated last week. He has just chosen several of his first disciples, and there is so much to accomplish. And yet here in today's gospel, we find him with his mother and his disciples as guests at a wedding. Some might think that this was a diversion from what Jesus was really about, but the truth is, it is exactly what he was about then and still is today, as we'll see. Moving into the lives of people at every phase of life, encountering them and allowing them to encounter him in very human times of tenderness, times of anxiety, times of rejoicing, and times of weeping. So here we have the scene. Jesus and his mother Mary and the disciples are in Cana of Galilee very shortly after Jesus' baptism by John in the Jordan River. Cana is just a few miles from Nazareth, and they're all there to attend the wedding of friends or possibly relatives. Jewish wedding feasts in Jesus' day were week-long events. They were open-ended kinds of feasts with guests continually coming and going all week. Can you imagine? Eating and drinking, singing and dancing, and just generally having a good time. At one point during this particular feast, possibly due to a miscalculation or maybe a lack of money or maybe just because the wedding guests were staying longer and drinking more than anticipated, whatever the reason, they run out of wine. And it's the making of a small crisis, because in this first century Mideastern culture, inviting guests to a wedding feast and then failing to provide them with enough food or wine would be the source of terrible embarrassment and maybe even lifelong disgrace for the wedding couple and their families, regardless of the reason. At any rate, what we see unfold is something that begins as a very human, very down-to-earth problem, but one which Jesus solves, as St. John tells us, with a manifestation of his glory. Historical tradition tells us that St. Joseph, Mary's husband, has died by now. And so it's quite likely that this aging Jewish widow is now somewhat used to depending on her son for solving problems and addressing needs. So you can picture this scene, can't you? Mary notices a problem, namely that the wine runs out before the guests do. And so she makes her way over to Jesus and she says to him very simply and concisely, "They have no wine." Notice she doesn't directly ask him to do anything, either miraculous or mundane. She simply makes a statement. They have no wine. But given the level of understanding that must have existed between Jesus and his blessed mother by now, there is no doubt in Jesus' mind what Mary's intent is. Her mother's heart is compassionately concerned for this couple's dilemma. And she goes to the one whom she knows beyond a shadow of a doubt can solve the dilemma. Now, we don't know whether Mary was implying that she wanted Jesus to perform a miracle, to supply the wine, or just that he and the disciples should go to the marketplace or one of the neighbors to see if they could buy or borrow some wine. The point is, there was a problem. She knew who could solve it, and so she just went to him and made him aware of the problem and left the details up to him. She left the details up to him. What a great lesson for us as we approach the problems and the crises of life, going to Jesus and treating him and then leaving the details up to him. More often than not, we go to Jesus with our PowerPoint proposal. We do the cost-benefit analysis with each bullet point thoroughly researched and concisely presented and say something like this: okay, Lord, here's the deal. Here's what's going on in my life. And if this happens, then this is going to happen. But if this doesn't happen, there's no way things are going to work out for me. And so here's what I need you to do, and this is how I need you to do it. And by the way, I need you to make sure that all of this happens by 5 p.m. on Friday, okay? Well, obviously that's not the approach that the Blessed Mother took. And yet we hear in Jesus' response to Mary something that at first reading sounds unduly harsh. He says to her, "O woman, what is that to you or to me? My hour has not yet come." First of all, our modern Western ears wince a little bit at hearing a son addressing his mother as woman. I think back to my own childhood and youth, and if I had ever addressed my Italian mother as woman, I would not be speaking to you through my natural teeth this morning. But in the Semitic cultures, this is not at all a sign of disrespect. To the contrary, recall, for example, Jesus' words to his mother as he tenderly committed her to St. John's care from the cross when he said, "Woman, behold your son." What Jesus is doing here is challenging Mary to remember his past words, "I must be about my Father's business." And now to consider an added dimension: "My hour has not yet come." Now, what hour was Jesus referring to here? To get a hint about this, we need to look ahead a little bit. In John 17, chapter 1, at the Last Supper, Jesus prays, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may also glorify you." The hour then was to be that time when Jesus would fully reveal his purpose for becoming a man in his suffering, death, and resurrection. And in that, the Father would glorify him and he would glorify the Father. As always, what Jesus is demonstrating is a relentless single-mindedness of purpose, one that directed all of his efforts toward the fulfillment of his Father's will for the redemption of mankind. At any rate, Mary doesn't directly respond to Jesus' challenge because she trusts that the Lord is not going to simply ignore the couple's plight. And so she speaks to the servants. But it goes deeper than that. Rather than trying to figure out and respond to the theological implications of what Jesus just said about the fact that his hour had not yet come, the Blessed Mother simply responds on the basis of what she knows about her son's goodness, his mercy, and his power. And in doing so, Mary's words become a permanent and ongoing exhortation to all people of all time. She says to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you. Do whatever he tells you." How simple, how good that admonition is. And let's understand something here. When Mary tells the servants, "Do whatever he tells you," she's taking a step in faith. This is a faith grounded in the word and the person of her son, and both nurtured and emboldened by her relationship with him. And you probably are aware, these words, "Do whatever he tells you are actually the last recorded words in the gospel that Mary ever spoke. And by the way, these words sound a lot like the words that Mary would speak, or had spoken rather, 30 years earlier to the angel Gabriel when she said, "Be it done unto me according to your word." Her words to Gabriel and her words to the servants expressed a faith-filled surrender to the Lord for the outcome. Authentic faith not only seeks for the Lord's will to be done in accordance with his word, it also leaves the method, the timing, and the outcome in his hands. So we see Jesus then instructing the servants to fill the 6 large water pots with water. And St. John tells us they filled them up to the brim. Notice that the servants obeyed both Mary's word and Jesus' word. She said, "Do whatever he tells you." He says, "Fill the jars with water." They filled them up to the brim. Now, these water pots were on hand for the purpose of your ritual purification, as Jewish law required. As the wedding guests arrived at the house, the water in these pots was poured over their hands for cleansing before they entered the feast, and of course to avoid the spread of COVID. I'm sorry. Forgive me for that one. So what we have in these water pots is some very rich and very significant symbolism. 6 large pots standing as remnants of the old covenant, which is about to be fulfilled. 6 large pots containing water that, like John's baptism, can bring ceremonial cleansing, but not life. Water that, like the old wine that the guests have consumed, has run its course and been depleted. Jesus therefore has the servants first fill them with fresh water and then to draw some for the steward of the feast to taste. And sometime between the moment that the water jars were filled to the brim and the moment that the steward tastes, a transformation takes place, a miracle occurs. What seconds before was common water is now wine. And not just any wine, but wine that is so uncommonly good that it prompts the steward, who apparently did not witness what Jesus had done and said to the servants, to make the comment he did to the bridegroom. And he alludes to the custom of serving good wine at the beginning of a feast and wine that was of lesser quality and therefore cheaper after the guests had been drinking for a while and wouldn't notice the inferior quality. And by the way, did you notice how much wine Jesus provided? I can remember having a conversation with my good friend who used to be the pastor of Belvedere Baptist, the church behind us, Wendell Ward. We used to have these friendly theological debates all the time. We'd go to lunch and discuss scripture and discuss doctrine and the differences between our Catholic doctrine and his Baptist doctrine. And I remember saying to him one time, "Wendell, you Baptists would have preferred that Jesus had turned wine into water." The text tells us that the servants filled 6 20 or 30 gallon pots. Now, if we call that an average of 25 gallons per pot, Jesus provided them with 150 gallons of wine. But here's the point. Every time we see Jesus in the Gospels filling a material need, we see him doing so in superabundance. Think, for example, of the multiplication of the 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish with which Jesus fed not only the 5,000 people, but from which there were 12 full baskets of leftovers. Think of the miraculous catch of fish, where at Jesus' words, the disciples caught so many fish in one cast that they couldn't get the net into the boat and they had to drag it to shore. Brothers and sisters, you and I do not serve a God of lack. but a God who desires to bless us abundantly in time of need. John concludes the story in verse 11 by saying this: "This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Much later, John would write in chapter 20 of his gospel in verses 30 and 31, quote, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So the story of the wedding feast at Cana provides us with one of the most elementary lessons in discipleship as followers of Jesus. Stated in its simplest terms, it portrays Our Lady stepping out in faith, laying a troublesome need at Jesus' feet, and leaving both the details and the solution to him. And in the process, giving us one of the most profound yet simple principles of discipleship: do whatever he tells you. And we see Jesus, in compassionate love and mercy, taking that burden upon himself and resolving it in superabundance with a miracle of transformation. And in the process, he gives us a subtle hint of what is in store for those who believe in him. Namely, just as we see with the superior wine in this miracle, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come as you continue faithfully and steadfastly following Jesus and walking in his word. Just as in this account, we symbolically see the old covenant give way to the new. And as we see common water give way to superior wine, so it is with us. Jesus wants to transform us and to do so in superabundance in accordance with the will of his Father. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.